And now, your ChillPack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
Hey everybody, here in the offices of Rational Exuberance, high above the historic core of downtown Los Angeles, in the middle of the Art Deco wonder that is the Eastern Columbia, this is your ChillPack Hollywood Hour. I'm here with your co-host and mine, Mr. Phil Lernis, ladies and gentlemen.
I love that you said... You address this to everyone who's in the offices of Rational Exuberance. You didn't even say from the offices. You said, hello, everyone here in the offices of Rational Exuberance.
I'm doing a local show this time.
There's a lot of us here.
Right.
We are legion today. No, you know what's interesting? Well, first of all, welcome to June, everybody. Welcome to this, the first Monday of June in the year of our Lord, 2015.
Anno Domini.
This is your ChillPack Hollywood Hour, year nine. We celebrated our, of course, our eighth anniversary show just a little less than a month ago.
Wow.
And you, Dean Haglund.
Yes.
Are in Australia right
what?
Now. What? So why did you say that we're coming at anybody from high atop the historic core of downtown Los Angeles? Is that because this show was... pre-recorded?
Oh, you did it again. Why we... I did it again.
Somehow, between our preparation for this show and you hitting record, you conveniently forgot that probably a different introduction was...
Yeah, from down under.
You're going to have to do it on the down low from down under.
That down low? Shouldn't it be I'm the thunder from down under?
I guess.
I don't know.
It's safe to say that the show is all asunder from down under.
From the Tropic of Capricorn.
So this is our first show post Dean Haglund's departure.
Yay.
You know, this is a pretty good time to bring this up, even though, you know, I kind of wanted to address this before, but I would often, when the news first was rumored, and of course the rumors are always true.
True.
People know this. When it was first rumored that Dean Haglund was going to be moving to Australia,
yes,
and when Dean would announce it at events like Big and Tall Show, and people would express often a certain sadness about Dean leaving, but shortly thereafter, everyone would ask me, "Well, what's going to happen to the podcast?"
Yeah,
and about three quarters of those people would really be concerned, which let me know that they cared. They like their ChillPack Hollywood Hour. About one quarter of the people would say, "So what's going to happen to the podcast?" And I said, "Well, no, it'll continue." And they'll say, "It'll probably be good for it. It'll probably mix things up a little bit, change things up." And I go, "Fuck you. We don't need anything changed up. This is perfect as it is."
No, I think maybe they're hinting that they want a format change.
So like a quarter of the people did.
Right.
Three quarters of the people were...
That's a very good way of doing an audience survey, having one of the co-hosts
move. That said... We then addressed the fact that you would be moving. We mm-hmm. made the announcement official on the show.
Right.
And...
I still got to make it official on Facebook, I guess.
You do realize that this is the first Monday of June.
Oh, yeah, right.
You have already made it official.
I don't know if I have.
2 months for Dean Haglund have gone by since he let everybody know officially that he was going to be going. More than 2 months. Of course, for me, since it's the first week of June,
right.
More than 4 months have gone by since you officially let everyone know this. You lost time traveling to Australia.
I did.
It's still March
months.
30th for you.
Ugh.
But it's June 3rd for me, and I would be remiss if I didn't wish my father a happy birthday, because it's his birthday today. Anyway, months would go by,
mm-hmm.
and people would post... comments on Twitter and on Facebook. Are you going to continue the show when Dean's in Australia? Or Dean, when you're in Australia, will you still be doing the show?
Right.
We'd already addressed that 2 months earlier. So congratulations. It will still continue. That's
Yay.
One. And two, thank you clearly for listening and keeping up with your ChillPack Hollywood Hour when we'd already addressed it.
Well, you know, people just like to know the show's there. You don't necessarily listen to every one of them.
Yeah, there's there's nothing really. I love how this just became a rant here. Rant filled year nine is what it's going to be.
Absolutely.
I love when a preview will be posted to the show, or you know, or a link to the actual show will be posted,
right,
with a little hint at what the show's about.
Uh-huh.
And the response will be a question tweeted or posted on Facebook or emailed saying, "Hey, what did you think about this?" Which would be answered if they would just
listen
to the actual show that you just linked to or previewed. Anyway.
Well, there you go. Well, it's an easy way to answer the questions, isn't it?
I'm grumpy on June 3rd, aren't
I? What the hell happened?
I think it has to do with my dad's birthday.
Oh, you didn't get him anything.
I have not, actually. Because when it comes to gift buying for my dad's birthday, it is... like it is with you, it is for me, March 30th. Happy June, everybody.
Yep.
So here's the thing. We're doing a special theme show. And it's not a top 10 countdown.
No.
So we didn't get to use the wonderful alternative opening of the show.
Right.
Top 10. and, of course, in fairness to you, nor did we do our brand new part Australia, part Los Angeles.
Oh, right.
Rendition of Chill Pack Hollywood Hours theme song.
Right. Theoretically, I'm still in the air. I don't know.
No,
I wouldn't be.
Boy, the flights get longer and longer. When you visited in March, it took you 48 hours.
Oh, yeah,
60 hours to get there.
Well, no, I'll be a basket case right now because the dogs are still in quarantine. And not knowing how we'll only get emails and perhaps a photo of them running in the field at the quarantine center. So we will be going, crawling up the walls in panic and fear and all those sort of things.
That's sad.
Yes, it is.
That is very, very sad. Well, we are doing a special theme show, and and I'm surprised we've never done this before, quite honestly, because we are proto-feminists. I don't know if that's even a thing.
Yeah, what is it? I don't know.
It sounds cool, though. I wanted to throw proto in front of it.
Proto-feminism.
We champion women in the media. Champion
women's rights.
And
equality.
We have done many shows where we talked about and even used and applied the Bechdel test to measure and examine the quality of roles women are getting in the media, and we both took great umbrage when a certain movie called Bridesmaids came out.
Yes,
at what you heard and read so often in the wake of that film's release, namely that Bridesmaids is the movie that proves women can be just as funny as men.
Right.
And our collective response was, who needed that proven?
Right. How did that, there's plenty of examples through history of the media and outside the media of funny women out there.
And so we thought we would do an entire show, pre-recorded though it might have been, so
right.
It is entirely possible that there will be somebody who emerges in the next 2 months that did not make the list.
That is even funnier than the women on our list.
But we thought we would go through our favorite funny ladies.
Right.
In the performing arts.
I love it.
So now I know, as a student and lifelong aficionado of early film and of silent film,
mm-hmm,
that your list will be much better versed where it comes to the
early turn of the century.
Eras,
yes,
those eras.
Pioneers.
And I'm eager to learn about some of these women and their work. Perhaps I will have heard of some of them and maybe seen a little bit of the work, but
right,
maybe we could try to do this in quasi-chronological sort of order as we come through the years.
Very good. Well, then let's start at the beginning. In the silent film era, there was one woman who was very funny with the Max Sennett Studio by the name of Mabel Normand.
Normand,
yes.
Okay.
Where Norman Desmond came from was actually a mix between Mabel Norman and her husband, Taylor Desmond, the director, who then Edna Provence, Charlie Chaplin's leading lady, married later on. So there's a small connection. But Mabel Nora was actually instrumental in Charlie Chaplin's career because the first film they did together, Making a Living, sucked, and Max Sennett thought he made a huge mistake. And it was Mabel, her power, and her comedic talents that convinced Max Sennett to keep Chaplin on for another film, and that started his career. So theoretically, Chaplin could have been fired, and you would never have heard of this guy if it wasn't for Mabel Normand. She was an early pioneer in not just as a comedic actress, director, producer, silent film, and she was one of the biggest stars at the time around 1914 to 1920-ish was her reign.
This last year at, I believe it was Silence Under the Stars,
mm-hmm.
Up at the Paramount Ranch.
Right.
In Calabasas, where you came out with the Patty and the dogs and saw, was it Last Warning? Was that the name of the mystery film?
Yeah.
But I saw a series of Chaplin shorts earlier in the summer, and one of them was a Mabel Normand short. I believe it was about marriage, and I wish I could remember the name of it.
Let's have look.
But of course, Chaplin was in it. But that was, as far as I could recall, my introduction to Mabel's work.
Right.
And she was every bit the star.
Star, major star. And she was, you know, good looking. This is always the comments of when I started in stand-up, it was still rare to have female stand-up comics. And the theory was, if you're good looking, if you're sexy, you are going to withhold within society standards and not try to be the fool, not develop a sense of humor, that you're just going to be a, you know, quote unquote, seen but not heard, you know, fashionable lady. And so here is a woman, Mabel Normand, very good looking and yet hilarious, had the comedy timing, the chops, and the skills of an actress who could both direct, write, produce, all that sort of stuff. And she also worked with Fatty Arbuckle, did 17 films with that guy. So she didn't just work with Chaplin. She was across the board. What was her big hit, though? That's the one. There was Tilly's Punctured Romance. Did you see that one?
You know what? I've seen Tilly's Punctured Romance.
Yeah.
Seen that. I saw it with a live accompaniment at Royce Hall at UCLA not too long
ago. Is that right?
Okay, so that was her.
That was her with Marie Dressler as the as Tilly. She's the bumpkin, country bumpkin that comes to the big city and then be Chaplin's lover.
So then who did Mabel Normand play?
She played the city slicker that's going to undo the relationship and rob her of her money and all that sort of thing. So she was working with she was playing a more evil female socialite that was going to get Marie Dressler in trouble. Kind of funny, actually. She did, that director, William Desmond Taylor, was actually murdered, and she was sort of implicated in that.
Oh, is that what brought an end? Because you said 14 to 20, and she was such a big star. And was so funny and was beautiful, and why... What brought an end to it? Because it wasn't like silent film.
No, there was a lot of scandal going on. Also, she developed a cocaine habit when cocaine was still legal, as you remember. Coca-Cola had real cocaine in it at the turn of the century. And so she had, unfortunately, developed a early cocaine addiction that sort of took a toll on her performing. And I forget who it was. There was a guy who, I think even married her, Lou Cody, And he sort of tried to keep her in and out of it. And then she got tuberculosis, of all things, and died at the age of 37. Think of that. So she did all of this by the time she was 37 years old. So
when someone dies at 37, it really lets me know how little I've accomplished with my life.
I know. I think the same thing, that you have all of this amazing career and you know, gone through ups and downs. And then at 37, it's all over. So,
hey, you, Phil Lernis, by the time Mabel Normand was your age, she was dead almost 10 years. What?
That is a hard fact, isn't it?
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
So do you have any other silent
I have female, yes.
Stars?
I do. You might like the It Girl, Clara Bow. She was called the It Girl because she had that it, that undefinable something that made her personality jump off the screen. And particularly in silent film, that was much harder to do. Your film quality stock was less, your, you know, all these barriers to actually seeing the performance come to the audience. It was often prints were poorly done, you know, that sort of thing. But Clara Bow, hilarious, bubbly, great timing. She did a ton of films. Mostly, she started as like one of these cheesy swimsuit model things.
Okay, all right.
And then developed into a leading lady where she did, now I'm trying to remember, she did a movie actually called The It Girl. Once the papers named her The It Girl, the studios got on board with that. And really funny and a great actress as well. She did some dramatic, she did 46 silent films and about 11 talkies, as they were called, including...
Oh, she really... Her stardom extended into
extended. She was in the very first Oscar-winning film, Wings, of 1927.
Of course, but that was a silent film.
Well, no. That
I
was
thought that was.
There's a copy of it silent, and then when sound came out, Howard Hughes says, we're doing the whole movie again
with
sound. So there's actually two prints of it out there. There's a silent print, and then there's a sound print, because, you know, Howard Hughes had that kind of money, and he wanted to be... He somehow, in the middle of production, he didn't hear sound was coming, so the film was released, and then they said, oh, yeah, no, everybody wants a talkie now. And so Howard Hughes did the whole movie again with microphones in it. Of course, her demise was also, well, there's a house in Beverly Hills that she owned early on, and she was known for her wild parties, including... the entire USC Trojan football team.
So this was not apocryphal, story?
No. This was her having...
This is true story.
True story. She, the football team was said they were never allowed to party at her place again after the neighbors complained of a completely naked touch football game going on in her front lawn at about 11 p.m. On one summer eve. So, you know, she liked to party, that girl. And... eventually, she got married in 31, and she died in 1965 of a heart attack. At the
well, so she lived quite a while.
Quite a while, but she was out of movies by the time, you know, around 1931. She retired from acting and moved to a ranch in Nevada and sort of lived out the last 30 years of her life there. So, but quite a reputation.
And so what's your favorite of hers?
My favorite of hers? There was one that she did, and wasn't The It Girl, and I'm trying to remember, and I'm just looking now at it, and it was hilarious. Just looking through her IMDb.
One would think one would be able to name off the top of one's head one's favorite.
I know. But she was like the flapper, right?
So who's your favorite of your children? Let me look up their names.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
What do you remember best about her? How about that?
Well, I'll tell you what I remember best about her. Physicality. So many of these comedians were known for their verbal wittage, but very few...
Especially in the silent era.
Well, okay, later on in my list. but her physical comedy prowess, because of her bubbly thing and her timing, like her comedy timing just in her... turns of her head and body, and she would stand out from a group of women that you would see, and it would be really quite amazing. So to me, it was like one of the few physical female comedians that was...
And that's interesting and kind of surprising coming from like the swimsuit model idea.
Yeah, right.
You certainly would not think, oh, well, that will be someone who can do the physical comedy.
Right. You trot those... remember, the girls had to take elocution lessons.
Yeah, you don't want to be goofy at all.
You walk around with a book on your head for hours at length to have perfect posture and all that sort of thing, that you would think the women are so corseted and buckled down that they wouldn't have any ability to express themselves physically in any sort of comedic way. But yet, there she was.
That's outstanding.
Yeah.
So who do you have next?
Well, the next one isn't on film. Have you ever heard of Ruth Draper?
I have heard of Ruth Draper.
This is a phenomenal story of a career. Ruth Draper is one of the early monologuists. She was a society woman at the turn of the century. She was born to a rich doctor family in New York at a time when women didn't go into acting.
In fact, is it did either She's About To or she just did. Annette Bening just played Ruth Draper on stage, didn't she?
I don't know about that. I would love
did
to
the see monologues.
That. Did the I monologues. Believe. She was such an amazing actor. Laurence Olivier, Katharine Hepburn, all of them have cited her as a major influence for their acting. And she would go on stage and do sometimes up to 2-hour shows with only a table, a chair, and a scarf to delineate characters from as far range.
So she'd be nude.
No, she wasn't nude. She'd have clothes on.
Oh, I see, but character clothes, costume
no
changes.
No costume changes, not elaborate things. So she would...
that was my proto-feminist speaking.
Yeah. She would do, like, go from rich art critic to a peasant girl in the street with just a flip of the scarf and amazed people. She actually toured... Think of this. In 1921, I believe it was, she toured Australia and made $50,000 in 1 month, in 1921 money. She originally just got her start touring the homes of the wealthy elites in New York.
I would work for 1921 money now.
I know, right? I know. Think of that. She was really successfully well. And there's recordings of her stuff that you can hear, but she, because her work... was so unique to the stage, she never transitioned into Hollywood film. She kept on doing stage work, and at a time when it was considered class A to be an actress, she actually only became a professional actress in 1920 after performing for almost 30 years in the parlors and bedrooms and living rooms of the wealthy, of the royalty. King George V invited her to England, and she performed for all the royal family, doing her monologues and all these characters. And she even did, early on, think of this, she did four women discussing diets and trying to order lunch in a 1920s context. She was doing Sex in the City as all four women as a hilarious sketch comedy bit. Oh, yeah.
So we can still find some of... these monologues, recordings.
Yeah, RuthDraper.com has all of her monologues recorded that you can hear. So, and it's you can buy the CD set, and I think YouTube has some of the recordings as well. Really fascinating to hear, but I am so, nobody filmed any of it.
What I love about your discussion of Ruth Draper is as you've let the microphone drop away from you, which means that Level Later will fix it, Level Later will also be then increasing the sound of the vacuum, which will give us a sense of what probably the quality of the recordings of Ruth Draper sound
yes,
like.
Exactly.
Was Dean Hagland actually in 1921 recording these thoughts about Ruth Draper? Who knows? Possibly.
Could very well be.
Possibly.
Yep.
Because he's in Australia, and for all I know, it still is 1921.
In their
there.
Audio technology.
Yeah. Yep. Wow, Ruth Draper is excellent.
Isn't
call.
That great? I love that.
I kind of want to find clips to put on this
I
show
know.
Sometime.
And you know how I got into that was in acting class. Everybody was talking about, Laurence Olivier. Oh, what a great actor. What's Laurence Olivier's influence? Do you want to pause that?
No.
Laurence Olivier's influence, and he unequivocally said it was Ruth Draper. None of the other actors, not Sir Garrick.
That's terrific.
It was Ruth Draper that really was
And
his
it
major
is influence. Interesting, isn't it, that I don't feel... radio, certainly, but film, it really wasn't until the 1980s, was it, that we even captured monologues... As film,
yeah.
And it was only, which was the same time that we had kind of concert films for stand-ups as well.
Yeah, that's right. It's only came out, I'm trying to think what would even have been the, there's some Lenny Bruce stuff that's on film.
It's funny that in the 1930s, when, quite frankly, you couldn't move the camera anyway, that there weren't more... efforts to recreate some of the great monologuists in a film
I think they
form.
Thought it was too visually unappealing. That's why, they were...
But some of those movies in the 1930s are visually unappealing.
Well, because they would lock it off on a play, They would just say, let's take a Broadway. That's why
exactly.
They were called what would they call them? Play stories. There was an early production house that just did Broadway plays, locked off a camera in the middle of the theater, and just re-recorded that and showed it in movie theaters.
So do you have any more from the early part of the 20th century?
Well, those are my favorites. Then we get into Myrna Loy.
Well, Myrna Loy is the first one I have on my
list. Oh, is that right? Well, let's talk
Myrna Loy. That's the first one. Yeah, that's the first one. You know, I mean, her and the Thin Man. I mean, that's she is cute as a button.
Right.
You can't not fall in love with Myrna Loy.
Yeah.
And funny how she always, we were talking about this, weren't we? That she was always cast to play Asian roles.
Yeah.
Often.
Which floored me that Loy is an Asian name.
But it's, yeah. I mean, it was changed to make it sound more, Asian.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, she's just so funny and smart. That's the thing.
Right.
Is she's not the goofy or silly young wife of William Powell,
right?
Who's much her elder. She's actually more the grown-up than he is.
Absolutely. And, yeah, as equal in terms of solving crime and put upon by William Powell's friends, criminal friends. Like, think of that. If you had, like, all these ex-convicts coming around, hanging around and drinking up your booze, wouldn't your like wife at the time just walk out in disgust? But there Myrna Loy was like,
she was so
character.
Great at delivering the cutting blows.
So great. And
and glamorous at the same time.
So true.
Yeah.
Love that.
You know, and not in a way that though would be intimidating to an audience. This wasn't Joan Crawford coming out glamorous and delivering the cutting blow,
right?
That elevated her. This was Myrna Loy kind of being on our side.
Yeah, exactly. That she's sort of the everywoman being funny, that is, and reacting how, if you had the graciousness of spirit, would react in such a situation.
Yeah.
It's so great.
So I don't have another until Lucille Ball.
Oh, well, I sort of had Marion Davies, William Randolph.
Oh, I would love to hear about this.
William Davies, Marion Davies, of course, was the longtime lover of William Randolph Hearst. As we know, we saw Citizen Kane, and as I say in my tour, my most racy bit, that... William Randolph Hearst.
We don't need to repeat the racy bit in a show about the funny ladies.
Okay.
But we can say that if anybody gets what they know about Marion Davies from Citizen Kane.
Right.
Which in many ways is an incredibly accurate and detailed and insightful depiction of Hearst and his relationships with the women in his life, including Davies, right down to the racy bit.
Right.
That he knew because he actually, well, he knew. But, you know, to his dying day, Wells did regret the depiction of Susan Foster Kane.
Oh.
That was patterned supposedly after Marion Davies, because he acknowledged that Marion Davies, you know, was a real talent.
Right.
And was also quite a big-hearted woman.
Yeah.
And Susan Foster Kane is depicted as a no-talent who's also quite shrill.
Yeah.
And he regretted that.
That negative result. And that, I think, probably affected the rest of her career because it's overshadowed by Hearst and her, you know, lifestyle.
I mean, her big-heartedness, is illustrating the fact that, you know, he never divorced. And so whenever his wife, who did know about her, of course, but would come out to visit with the kids, Marion Davies would have to pack up and leave her own residence
to be
away.
Go to the beach house in Santa Monica.
And, of course, so she's still living in style, living in luxury and all this.
Right.
But flash forward a few years, not only does Marion Davies stay with Hearst, not only was their love real, but when he goes bankrupt, she ends up keeping him financially afloat. Can you imagine that?
I know.
You know, and that's also not at all, the kind of relationship Citizen Kane would depict.
Right.
So, brilliant movie, but not a documentary.
Not a documentary, exactly.
And indeed, right, the original title of Citizen Kane was American, because it was about a certain type of era of America.
Yeah.
From muckraking journalism to the tycoons who positioned themselves as champions of labor until there were unions.
Until there were unions, right.
So, but this is what's interesting is that I don't know if I know, so I know much about Marion Davies, both the real woman Marion Davies.
Right.
And the fictional Marion Davies enjoyed the movie that was about her. Was it Cat's Meow, the Bogdanovich film?
Yeah, about the murder on the ship.
But I don't know her work.
Well, she was the Floridora girl. Do you remember that term? They did it again in our gang series. But the Floridora girl was sort of a dancing, early turn of the century, pre-vaudeville sort of music hall, not kind of rockettes, but they were sort of... The Floridora girls were...
Could we say that it's proto-Rockette?
We could say we met a Rockette, I suppose. But she did a movie in 1930, a sound film called The Floridora Girl, that sort of was an examination of that. She did a lot of musicals and comedies in the early 30s. Not So Dumb. Do you remember that one?
I don't. No. I've not seen... I don't
You're not
think
seen
I've
any
seen
of these.
Them. No.
She was really funny, though, and she had the chops, and she could sing... But again, being in William Randolph Hearst, he would often finance the films.
Right.
And then a lot of people didn't trust the reviews because they were in Hearst papers and stuff like that. So that would always favor her kindly, which, you know, was...
And she never, therefore, got to work with the best directors or the best writers.
Kind
or,
of thing,
or,
yeah.
Or this. So, there was, so someone of legitimate talent who might have actually been held back in their career...
Kind of.
...by someone who was trying to make sure that her career was successful...
Yeah.
...isn't that interesting. I mean, that sounds like risk management.
It does.
Nothing creative ever came out of trying to manage risk...
Exactly.
...or manage your investment...
Totally.
...in a creative enterprise. So, you know, I mentioned Lucille Ball. I mean...
Is she next? Yeah, I guess so.
You know, I mean, this was a woman who was acting in movies in the 40s, right?
True. She even auditioned to be Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind.
I mean, I've seen her in a couple of early noirs, you know, where... and it's interesting because another woman on my list got her introduction into films in noir in very serious roles, and Lucille Ball is the good gal pal who gets the detective out of a serious jam. And, I mean, it really wasn't until, you know, the 1950s, and I Love Lucy that...
Right. So she started the series before she did the comedies, like the Long, Long, Long Trailer, or
I
whatever.
I think so,
that,
yeah.
Because that came after, right? I always get those timelines mixed up.
But I got to tell you, I never really was a big I Love Lucy fan. I knew of it. I admired it without necessarily enjoying it. And it's only in recent years that I sit down and I watch these and I love them.
Right.
And
you see the craft of comedy timing and gag setup.
But I knew Lucy as a little boy watching The Tonight Show. And Lucille Ball would come out and guest. Or Lucy would be on the Dean Martin Celebrity Roast.
Oh, that's right.
And I knew Lucy's... was it Here's Lucy, the 1970s sitcom
right.
that she had?
Yeah.
So this is Lucy as a very mature woman, and she was so powerful
still
in her comedy.
Totally bringing it.
And that's what fascinated me was, I mean, this was a powerful woman
yeah.
in comedy. And when you see the Lucy of Desi and Lucy, of I Love Lucy, the comedy always comes out of her powerlessness.
Right. Of being,
which is fascinating.
Yeah, so that she could change that. And considering at that time, even though she's playing powerlessness, she's also producing. Desi Lu Productions produced Star Trek.
Oh, yeah.
Think of that.
Oh, our friend John Giroto told us that at one point, I think they owned the most sound stages in the city,
right.
more than any of the studios, because they just were all spread out.
Right.
And they didn't have their own lot, although Desi Lu's lot was half, or not half, but a significant portion of what is now, you know, Paramount. It was RKO and Desi Lu, and Paramount has it. I heard that the Lucy stage is actually going to be
torn down. What?
But her dressing room's still there.
It's amazing.
But yeah, a powerful, powerful woman.
And what a long career then, too, to keep going right up until the 70s. And that was daily. I mean, she worked daily, but those were weekly episodes that were churning out, often live, and always written. You know, think of that pressure that you had to be under back then to do a weekly comedy series in front of a live audience.
I'm trying to look this up. There was a huge television personality, newsman, television host here in Los Angeles for many decades, named Ralph Story.
Oh, yes.
Do you know Ralph Story?
I heard of Ralph Story.
Ralph Story was a big deal. It's impossible for anyone anymore with cable and hundreds of channels to think that the most important personality on a television set could be a local personality.
Uh-huh.
But it was true.
Right.
This was because you only had a few hours of national programming.
Right.
Most of your programming was local. And Ralph Story was a really big deal. But one of the things that I learned about him when I was watching a special of his, because he's been dead for many years, but a rebroadcast of one of his specials on PBS during one of their pledge drives, and Stephanie Edwards, local television personality, Stephanie Edwards,
right,
worked for him and talked about how, you know, he was once an actor and he studied comedy in the most sought-after comedy classes being taught here in Los Angeles in the 50s, which were taught by Lucille Ball.
Really?
She taught comedy.
That's amazing. I did not know that. So,
can you imagine getting to study comedy with Lucy?
No, I can't, but my favorite story is... Chris Penna is a comedian and improviser that I've worked with in town, and he went to Beverly Hills High. And so one day they thought they would do a stage play of Some Like It Hot. And they did it because they wanted to kiss, they want to audition girls who look like Marilyn Monroe and get to kiss them. So her and this other guy said, oh, well, my mother can help us. And they got the original script and original costumes from Some Like It Hot because the guy's mother was Lucille Ball.
Wow, as
a junior, so that was his best friend in high school. I know, right?
Another woman whose career goes back to the golden age, and who, like Lucy, really grew into being such a powerful, a formidable force on screen, and yet began as something quite opposite. Not opposite it. You could still see the root in it, but it's still an astonishing transformation. Because as we know, a lot of people whose vulnerability or powerlessness is at, you know, essential to their appeal and to their making it big, for them, especially when it's women, for them to mature into being a formidable force on screen is really a rare transition.
It's true.
Katharine Hepburn was formidable when she started.
Ah.
Right?
Right.
But Shirley MacLaine.
Ah.
Young ingenue, Shirley MacLaine.
That's right. Hanging out with the Rat Pack, Shirley MacLaine.
How funny and heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But how brilliant is some of her physical bits, her takes, her way with a line, her sharpness, while still maintaining this innocence and naivete in a film like The Apartment.
Yeah.
Or in one of my favorite Hitchcocks, The Trouble with Harry.
Oh, yeah. So great.
I mean, fell in love with her in The Trouble with Harry. And by the way, there's a recurring theme that's going to happen here. Myrna Loy, Shirley MacLaine. At various times in my life, huge crushes on these women. Absolutely. I'm serious.
Yeah, that's
because
hilarious.
Because they are so funny, but the humor also, like with Myrna Loy, it makes her one of us.
Right.
She's approachable in that way, even though she's so elegant and beautiful. Shirley MacLaine is, you know, one of the most beautiful creatures that ever lived, but there was something about her vulnerability that allowed us to feel like, again, we're protective of her.
Yeah, I know. That's weird, isn't it? It's the idea that that your comedy comes from a real place, and that real place becomes something that's, you know, emotionally not raw, but it's a vulnerable emotional sharing.
And although she was powerful and formidable and no longer an ingenue in any way, but still, terms of endearment, right? Shirley MacLaine's comedy is still coming from a real place, and it's still breaking your heart even as it makes you laugh.
I know. Such a rare combo. Laughing through tears. It's what you want.
I don't have anyone else until the 1970s.
Is that right?
Well, 60s. Let's say it's 60s.
Yeah. Well, now we go to... I thought Ethel Merman, if you think about her in terms of a Broadway star who then transitioned... You know, by the time she came to the movies, she was much older... And, you know, sort of a brassy, loud women that...
I know her from her cameo in Airplane. That's
that's it?
How I know her.
Oh, my God. You didn't see Annie Get a Gun or all the other amazing... she had a set of pipes on her.
Well, I knew that. Obviously, I've heard some recordings and things now, but...
But she also was really funny, and I, you know, longed to hear or go back in time and see her on Broadway. But from descriptions of her doing comedy on Broadway, they would have to hold the show. The show would take an extra 30 minutes because of just laughter, because they would just pause for laughter, and the running time of the show would be at an extra 30 minutes because Ethel Merman was on stage. That's how funny she was,
wow,
apparently. So they had to readjust the timing for the plays because, you know, in rehearsal, oh, yeah, it's a, you know, 90-minute play. But with her doing the comedy, it suddenly became a 2.5-hour play. So funny. I can't even think of their Annie Get Your Gun. She sang No Business Like Show Business in what movie? I forget.
All right.
But that's then we're all up into the 60s now.
In the 1960s, mm-hmm. I would watch the show, love the show, still love it. And even if I didn't love it, would still watch it for her. Mary Tyler Moore.
Oh, yes.
As Dick Van Dyke's wife.
Mm.
The Dick Van Dyke Show is... so good.
Still so good.
Still so good. And I mean, you know, she started as a leggy, hot dancer type.
Right.
And, but so vulnerable, so silly, so goofy.
Right.
And just fantastic. And then...
to get her own show.
To mature into the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and not only to still be so funny, but to be so confident in her own power that everyone around her had to be as good as her.
Yeah.
And think about, talk about funny ladies. I mean, okay, Bridesmaids, whoever said this is what proves that women have been funny, you'd clearly never watched a single episode of the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
I know.
Hello, you've got Mary Tyler Moore, Cloris Leachman, Betty White,
right?
Georgia Engels.
Yeah. And then...
I never was a big fan of Valerie Harper. I'm not going to lie about that.
I was
going
to say Valerie Harper.
I never was a big Valerie Harper fan.
Really? You didn't watch Rhoda?
Not unless I was being like punished. but okay. But yeah, all these women, and Cloris Leachman, of course, right there. I mean, her work with Mel Brooks. She's funny, again, even when she's heartbreaking.
Right.
When she does allow herself to show vulnerability, which she has not most of her career.
Right.
But when she's showing her vulnerability, and this is who I was referencing, in her first film when she was introduced in the very odd and oddly funny film noir, Kiss Me Deadly.
She's in that?
And also, of course, in her Oscar-winning Last Picture Show.
Oh, yeah.
She's heartbreaking and funny. And, you know, but this was just, I mean, ground zero for funny women.
Yeah.
And that's the thing is that, again, the 1970s on television, you still had Lucy having a show. You had the Mary Tyler Moore Show. You had the Carol Burnett Show.
Who's on my list. So many of these women. And they're carrying the show for season after
season. And nobody had any problem.
Right.
And the men were the subordinates.
Absolutely.
Brilliant subordinates. Who's more brilliant than Harvey Korman? Or
and Tim Conway.
Know, but
still, the woman's leading it.
And how could we be having this conversation years later? How could people be looking back and thinking that, wow, Gilda Radner really made comedy safe for ladies, didn't she?
Yeah.
And Gilda Radner was brilliant.
Yeah.
But my God, in prime time in the 1970s, if you were a huge comedy star, the odds are you were a woman.
It's true. And
Bea Arthur.
And Maude. Yeah, think of all of that. Even Jean Stapleton pulling the comedy in All in the Family was amazing.
But Mary Tyler Moore, and she still has it. I mean, I, you know, I haven't seen anything in the last few years. But if you go at least back to the 90s, to like Flirting with Disaster,
oh yeah,
her turn in that is so funny,
yeah.
So neurotic,
totally.
Too. You know, yeah. Which is not what you would have expected when you think of her from. But you know, she, a brilliant performer.
So one on my list in that time sort of comes earlier, but I think Phyllis Diller gets a mention.
I'm glad
here.
you yeah.
Yeah, because so
I don't know, I just don't, I know her work from obviously from again the roasts, and I know them from game shows.
Right.
But I don't really know her nightclub act. But I've been, you know, I've seen documentaries.
Yeah.
about her work.
Right.
And I really admire it, but I don't know enough of her work.
Well, at a time when housewives weren't supposed to be doing stand-up comedy, she got her start, of all things, on Groucho Marx, You Bet Your Life. She was a contestant, and Groucho, you know, spends hours talking to the guests, hoping to find some comedy, and goes, "So, Phyllis, what do you do?" And she said, "I'm a comedian," on national television. She states that, and he goes, "Oh, you want to do a little of the act?" And so she actually, un-Phyllis like, her hair is in a bouffant, like it's not wild and crazy. She doesn't have a cigarette in a cigarette holder, does not have a giant fur scarf around her neck or anything like that, or feather. She had a big giant feather boa in her later stage life. I remember distinctly one of my favorite jokes is, "I've been going to therapy. I'm doing much better now. He lets me sit up."
Oh my goodness.
And it was just like, it was so deadpan. It was, you know, she's just in a suit. The crowd killed. And from there, her stand-up career started. And, you know, here's the thing that you go, you know, these women are beautiful and stuff like that. She exemplified self-depreciation comedy,
yeah,
but also her husband, Fang, demonetizing him and making her all the more vulnerable, funny, as a joke writer, unbelievably talented.
When I started to get to know her work, I saw some of her. I saw her as the forebear for one of my favorites, who I really kind of worshipped for several years, which was Sandra Bernhardt.
Yes,
and you know, her one woman shows, also
right. Her Without
performance,
You Nothing.
Yeah, and her performance in King of Comedy.
Oh yeah, so dark.
Which is one of the great combination. People remember what a great combination of character, of actor bringing their own baggage to a role it was when Jerry Lewis plays Jerry Langford.
Right.
But Sandra Bernhardt was bringing her stage persona to that role in King of Comedy.
Yeah.
And those scenes with Jerry Lewis
so
are some of the best scenes you'll ever see.
Yeah.
So I found, it really occurred to me that Phyllis Diller paved that way, that there was much of what you just described about the self-deprecation as a way of finding your own power.
Right.
That I thought was astonishing.
Yeah, and that became Joan Rivers' thing, and then, you know, a lot of comedians do that now.
And, you know, that ability to act it, to bring that persona into acting. Now, she hasn't had a lot of opportunities to do that,
right,
and a lot of times it's stunt casting, but
yeah,
that's where it was, it served the character. You know, we were talking about how, as a businesswoman and as a producer, Lucille Ball was so powerful and so admirable. We'd be remiss if we didn't point out the same thing about Mary Tyler Moore. I mean, she was producing her shows,
yeah,
and she produced many other shows through MTM.
Right. And so, Grant Tinker, right? It was
Her husband.
Her husband.
So this is another, you know, woman who made her mark through, you know, because not only are these funny women, and you went going back to those silent eras, some of these were they were powerful women within the business.
Yeah.
Because not only are they funny, they're super smart.
Super smart.
As many of the funniest people tend to be. So this is also why I developed these incredible crushes at time in my life on these women who may have been long since dead even, because boy, they're super smart.
Right.
And super funny.
Right.
And powerful, while still being able to be one of us.
Absolutely.
Or make us feel protective
of
them.
Or even playing ditzy, which then brings me, I should go back, there's one name I forgot. Gracie Allen of Burns and Allen.
I thought you were going to say Goldie Hawn, but of course, Gracie Allen's the forebear for
Goldie Hawn. Yeah, absolutely. That's the model, because she played...
Yeah, boy, she was really good. People forget how... She was the star of Burns and Allen.
Oh, yeah. George... apparently, early on in their career, they were a dance team, and they were hoofers, and so they did soft shoe and stuff like that. And then in between dance numbers, they would talk, and so they began a patter. But it being still vaudeville, George was the comedic guy, and Gracie was supposed to be the straight man. But George realized early on people were laughing more at the setup than the punchline. So he just reversed it, and he made him the straight man and Gracie the comedian.
That's brilliant.
And often he would just go on stage and go, "So how's your brother?" And that would be their 45.
And then
45.
She would go.
She would go, and he would just go, "Huh?" And then say, "Goodnight, Gracie." That was the whole set. That's all he had to do.
How many more do you have on your listing, Hagelin?
I got two more. How about that?
Because we have 12 minutes, and I've got 13 people.
Okay, let's go yours.
No, by all means. I mean, we can do a lightning round.
But, yeah, okay, let's do. I have Carol Burnett, of course. Janeane Garofalo.
It's a, oh, okay. Well, yeah. Well, those, that, Janeane Garofalo. Who was the other one?
And Judy Gold. Do you know her? She's
no,
a stand-up.
Tell me about...
Oh, just a hilarious stand-up. I worked with her in New York. She makes me laugh all the time. Tall.
Is she present? She's contemporary?
She's present. Oh, okay. Yeah. I don't know if she's actually still performing as much as she used to, but really smart, tall comedian, taller than most other comedians. And, you know, I don't think she gets enough credit in the stand-up.
Judy Gold.
Judy Gold. Take a look.
I need to look this up.
Yes.
Absolutely. And Carol Burnett, sadly, someone who I think people in other countries really don't know. They don't know her work.
Is that right? Did
but
not
boy,
get up there.
Brilliant. And just the reverence that people in this business have for her because of her genius.
Oh, yeah. And confidence.
Do you know, we don't get the Larry Sanders Show. Larry Sanders Show does not survive if it is not for Carol Burnett.
Yes.
She was the first major star to agree to play themselves because it was a show that was dependent on their talk show format, but no one had seen it.
No one had seen it.
And she was the first one who said, well, Gary Shandling's brilliant. I don't care if he's not famous. He's brilliant. Of course I will be on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was that opened the door, and everybody said, oh, you got Carol Burnett? How can I sign up?
Yeah, how do I get on?
Even though they hadn't seen the show.
Yeah.
And that's quite a testament.
It sure is.
So someone I've been watching a lot lately who died way too young, and, you know, this woman was just seemed absolutely nuts. And in every performance you would see, you would think you'd see how nuts she could get, and she would get more nuts.
Right.
And at the same time, she was really oddly sexy, but in a really mentally ill kind of way, but could sing, but would sing so bad that it would mask how good she could sing. And she would dance so poorly that it would kind of disguise how brilliantly balletic she was.
I have
no
idea.
I'm talking about Madeleine Kahn.
Ah, of course.
I mean, boy, just rattling off the
Young Frankenstein, Blazing Saddles,
Von Stupp in Blazing Saddles. In Young Frankenstein, of course. Oh my God! Just the scene on the platform when they're kissing goodbye and they can't touch each other.
No touch. Yeah, it's
so great. And Sherlock Holmes' smarter brother and Clue. She has a scene in Clue that I watch again and again and again.
Yep.
I hated him so much. Waves of hatred. Madeleine Kahn could do no wrong for me.
She started. Was just so I think brilliant. She was an early Second City alumni, if I'm not mistaken. So she, I believe that was her early training, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not sure, but she certainly had the chops.
Lily Tomlin. I don't know you introduce Lily Tomlin. I mean, they did a whole Kennedy Center honors, and I guess we could just play that to introduce her. But on stage and on screen, in sketch or in long form,
on Laughing,
as an actress in movies. I mean, she was Oscar nominated for supporting actress for Nashville.
Yeah. Her and Steve Martin in All of Me.
Oh my goodness. So good.
Yeah.
And again, David O. Russell, who worked with Mary Tyler Moore in Flirting with Disaster with I Heart Huckabees.
Right.
But she really was beloved by Altman. Gave a terrific little performance as Meryl Streep's sister in Altman's final film, The Prairie Home Companion.
Prairie Home Companion.
But Lily Tomlin is just astonishing.
Yeah, and her Broadway show...
Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe, written by her wife, of course.
Yeah, it's so amazing.
Well, it is. I saw it when I was in the 1980s. And so Lily Tomlin, interestingly enough, is one of the reasons that our Lily Holloman wanted to become a performer.
Uh-huh.
And really, she's one of the reasons that I got into show business as well, because of how much that show turned me on.
I know a friend of mine saw it, and in reenacting it, she started crying because that's how funny. I was laughing, but she was in tears because it was such an emotional experience seeing that show.
You know, someone who really, this isn't for live performance, it isn't for writing, it is her as an actress.
Mm-hmm.
But I tried to stay away from people who were funny because of the words that were written for them. You know, exclusively.
Yeah.
But after 40 plus years of being both really a powerful dramatic actress, but someone who, no matter how dramatic it was, always managed to find the humor in those scenes. I think it's safe to say that Maggie Smith is a funny lady.
Yes, absolutely.
Doesn't it always delight you when you see her on screen?
It's true.
No matter how venal or vile even the characters might be, or how compassionate and loving they might be,
right?
It's always delightful because you always, there's something
so charming.
You know she's going to make you laugh at times and at unexpected moments.
I'm trying to think if she did an all-out comedy.
Oh, Murder by Death.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Where she plays David Niven's, plays basically Nora Charles, Nora Charleston right. in the parody of it, but plays, the thin man's wife.
That's true.
So Maggie Smith. Another actress who was really, to me, as funny as it got in the 1980s, mm-hmm. in her work with Woody Allen, was Mia Farrow.
Oh.
Somebody asked whether I was going to have Diane Keaton on this.
Right.
But the one for me who always really busted me up was actually Mia Farrow.
Mia Farrow beforehand.
What an amazing combination they were together. But the way that she brought his writing to life, even playing the Woody Allen role.
Yeah.
The only one who is maybe...
Woody Allen.
More Woody Allen than Woody Allen.
Totally.
Was Mia Farrow.
Fantastic.
Someone else from the
80s,
who is another one of the reasons that Lily Holloman, one of the two performers that really, the three performers that made Lily want to get into show business were Lucille Ball, Lily Tomlin, and Tracy Ullman. And of course,
Lily got
a recurring part on Tracy Ullman's State of the Union.
Right.
Her sketch work on the Tracy Ullman show, and again, as a producer.
As a producer.
Thank you for The Simpsons.
Right. Yes.
But
and character work.
And her.
So.
And her
amazing.
Film work, again, she did Woody Allen. Her work with John Waters. But I saw her recently in Into the Woods.
Oh, yeah.
She plays Jack's mom.
Yeah.
And she's so good in it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so beautiful. I mean, I suddenly realized here's a woman who's been around for 30 years and often has spent her time making herself up to look ugly.
Right. In some lots of way. Heavy makeup or playing men and beards and stuff like that.
What a beautiful woman she
so
is.
Amazing.
And again, so smart and just a beautiful, I mean, just beautiful inside and out.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, again, her satire can be so biting, and yet she as a woman is so loving and compassionate and kind.
Right.
And,
amazing. Reminds me of Catherine O'Hara from SCTV, actually.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, I forgot to put Andrea Martin and Catherine O'Hara on my list.
Catherine O'Hara is
sure.
wonderful. SCTV, yeah.
Okay. Your last.
Let me wrap this up. You mentioned Janine Garofalo.
Yeah.
Boy, I developed such a crush on Janine Garofalo in stand-up.
Yes. So smart.
Loved her also on the Larry Sanders Show, even though she was in Out of Her Depth at that point as an actor.
But she did the Ben Stiller sketch comedy show with Odenkirk and Andy Dick.
Yeah.
And there she really shined. So her character work there was amazing.
And I would love to see a Janine, not that she needs a comeback, but I'd like to see something that really would allow her now to show off who she was and what she has matured into. And I haven't seen it.
No. I don't know. I haven't even seen her advertised
live
somewhere.
You know, she's become
somewhere.
Such a pundit.
Yes. I guess that's it, isn't it?
And I'd really love to see what she could embody today because, again, she was super smart. A woman that I think does get the opportunity occasionally and who I've always been just head over heels in love with, Sarah Silverman.
Oh, yeah, of course. I remember her at the Improv working together. So funny and charming.
Absolutely charming, even when she's pushing the boundaries beyond where they should be pushed.
Absolutely.
She's so charming.
Yeah, right? My favorite bit, she doesn't do it anymore, but it's the end of Entertainment Weekly before they go to the commercial. It's like, it's celebrity birthdays, which the following killed 6 million Jews, was it? Warren Beatty, Adolf Hitler, or we'll tell you the answer when we come back. So funny.
Two other longtime comedy crushes that I had. Amy Sedaris,
yes.
of course.
So,
Strangers with Candy, still one of my all-time favorite shows.
Mm-hmm.
And Tina Fey, when she started hosting Saturday Night Live, I mean...
You saw it. You saw the whole future of comedy right there. You knew she was going to do...
Yeah, and again, a brilliant, smart woman as a producer, a writer, and a performer.
Mm-hmm.
She incredibly gifted in all those areas. I think it's possibly safe to say now if we couldn't even 20 years ago. But there is no... if there is a Rushmore of comedic actresses on television, up there with Lucy, with Mary Tyler Moore, with anybody else that you want to add, but certainly they're on there, maybe Carol Burnett.
Ah.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Yes.
And I thought about this because the new ad for Veep has her on Rushmore.
Yeah, yeah.
This land is her land. And this is not just a woman who's given a script and is funny with it, but that would be enough because she's a great actress.
Great.
But her improvisational technique and methods that she brings to Veep, that she brought to...
Seinfeld? Think of that.
And, of course, she did a very unheralded stint on Saturday Night Live, but that is her background.
Yeah. For sure.
And she's on that Rushmore list.
But there you go.
So, well, I need to conclude with, I thought, is there someone that's now stepping in?
Right.
Who I just love. And somebody who I've watched develop, and who I'm just falling in love with more and more on a weekly basis, is Carrie Brownstein on Portlandia.
Oh, yeah.
I watched that show initially because of the Targets and because of Fred Armisen.
Right.
I now watch it because of Carrie Brownstein.
Isn't that amazing?
She is such a gifted performer.
Yeah.
And again, I love her. I'm protective of her.
I want to go back and hear music from her all-girl band that I never partaked before. You know me, who don't like music.
And, you know, it's interesting for us to be making this our first show after you've left for Australia, because next week we're actually going to take a little sabbatical.
What?
And we are going to have, for the first time ever, two guest co-hosts.
Oh.
And they're going to be handling many of the things that you love about your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, the live events of the week, the lawsuits of the week, the latest news and reviews. But they might want to...
discuss
what we talked about today, because after all, they are two of the funniest women we know.
Right.
And you have enjoyed their work here on your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Lily Holloman and Karen Foreman,
right,
who will soon be starting their own podcast, but we get them first.
Ah.
Guest hosting, guest co-hosting.
Guest co-hosting.
Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. And
I thank them in advance.
Can I, instead of doing our usual song, can I just end with a little story?
Yes.
That I've always loved?
Let's hear it.
When the great Federico Fellini brought Giulietta Messina to meet his best friend, when they'd first met and fallen in love after World War II.
Right.
This is before Fellini was a big deal. Obviously, before Messina was a celebrated actress,
right,
who would be hailed as basically Italy's answer to Harpo Marx. That's what a brilliant, funny woman she was.
Right.
But he'd gotten engaged and he brought her to meet his best friend, who would be his best man. And the best friend pulled Fellini aside and said, "Well, she's very charming, but I'm worried because she's not at all like the women you usually go for, who were these statuesque, buxom, you know, bombshells."
Right.
You know, she's not like that. And Fellini said, "Ah, but this one makes me laugh."
Nah.
And, of course, they had a lifelong collaboration and
Look
partnership.
At that.
And
well, marriage. There you go.
And that brings us to an end of this installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Mm-hmm. You can find so many of the episodes at chillpackhollywood.com. CHILLPAK Hollywood.com. Please write us
at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com.
Ask Dean about travel tips for when visiting Australia.
I have plenty of them.
Follow us on Twitter.
Yep, we're at Dean and Phil.
And like us on Facebook.
It's easy.
Facebook.com/ChillPackHollywood. Till next week, or the week after that.
Maybe.
When we'll be back.
Yes.
But of course, join Lily and Karen next week for your Chill Pack Hollywood, brought to you, as always, by Empire State Gas and the good folks at Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you.